Over the last week or so, as I reflected on Indigenous Peoples Day and how our service might have a meaningful connection to it, I have to admit, I struggled. I didn't want there just to be token references. Didn't just want to change the readings for the day to fit the ones chosen by the Anglican Council of Indigenous Peoples and just leave it at that. And I struggled with how I was to preach. Usually, while I might share a brief personal story in a sermon, I usually spend a fair bit of time with our scriptures, trying to help us to explore and to wrestle with what God might be saying to us. Well, today, things are going to be a little bit different. Today, there are going to be more stories. Stories from my childhood. Stories that I believe that God has used and is using to help shape me into who I am becoming. Then we'll spend a short time reflecting on our scriptures, and finally I'm going to be saying something about the horrific discovery in Kamloops a few weeks ago. And in it all, it's my desire to speak with humility, knowing full well that my experience is limited. I have a long way to go to understand, to draw alongside, and to enter into meaningful conversation with my Indigenous brothers and sisters. And so I just want to flag that right here. I'm not sure whether I've ever mentioned this in a sermon before at Holy Trinity, but I'm a killer whale. I belong to the killer whale tribe of the Nisga people of the Nass Valley of northern British Columbia, and I've been part of that tribe since I was 6.5 years old. Let me just give you some of the background. When I was 6, my dad was elected to be Bishop of Caledonia, a 300,000 square mile diocese in northern British Columbia, and home to the Haida, Tsimshian and Nisga people, and other Indigenous peoples as well. Prior to Dad's election, we had been living in northeastern British Columbia in Fort St. John, but upon his election, we moved to Prince Rupert. I can still remember Dad's service of consecration. The cathedral in Prince Rupert was too small to hold everybody who was going to be there, so we had to have the service at the local high school. The service was a mixture of liturgy. There was familiar things and things that weren't so familiar. I think to a 6.5-year-old, likely it was the music that showed me the greatest diversity. I'd never been to a service before where Indigenous people sang in their own language. I'd never been to a service before where Indigenous people beat drums, wore traditional clothing, and danced ceremonial dances. There was me in my little gray suit with a white shirt and a little bow tie, and then there were others who were draped in beautiful button blankets, wearing moccasins and dancing there before us. After the service came time for an evening reception. I can remember as a family us walking into the hall where the reception was being held and people clapping to welcome their new bishop. I can remember there being lots of food at the tables. Some of those foods were things I'd eaten before, and then there were things that I hadn't. And when it came to those foods, I was just as happy to leave them on the table. The next thing that stands out of my memory was what came after the meal. There were speeches. There was more ceremonial dancing, and again, many people wearing the traditional button blankets. In one of the speeches, it was announced that Dad and Mom were going to be adopted into Nisga families. Pat and Phyllis McMillan, who lived in Port Edward, a neighboring community, but originally came from what was called, at that time, was called New Ianch, in the Nass Valley. They were going to be adopting my dad, And then Hannah Tate, also from New Iange, would be adopting my mom. They were adopted into different tribes because you couldn't be married to somebody who was from your same tribe. So Dad was adopted into the Raven tribe and my mom into the Killer Whale one. Now, the Nisga people, they are a matrilineal people. And so because Mum was a killer whale, that meant that we three kids were killer whales as well. Both my parents were given Nisga names. My dad was given the name Walax, which meant bearer of the living water. My mom was given the name Kasimklox, which meant daughter of the moon. And Dad was given a button blanket and a bishop's mitre from the Nisga people. Now, we three kids, we weren't given new names, but we certainly did feel welcomed into a new family. We didn't have much contact with Mum's adopted family because they lived quite a ways from where we did. But we had a great deal of connection with Dad's family. Often we went to visit them throughout the year. Patrick, or Pat as he was known, was always sitting at a table in the background. He was a very, very quiet man. But Phyllis, wow, she was a woman who, as far as we kids could tell, she loved us like her own. Whenever we arrived at the door, her face would light up. I was proud to be a killer whale. And growing up, I felt an affinity to killer whales. Remember on a school field trip going to Metlakatla, which was a small neighboring indigenous village near Prince Rupert. And I was walking on the beach of Metlakatla and seeing the dorsal fin of a killer whale out in the water. I remember telling Granny Phyllis about the experience and her speaking as though that whale was part of my family. I have other memories from when I was growing up in Prince Rupert. And some of the trips we took as a family to some of the indigenous communities in the diocese. Easter was often a time when we would travel to the villages, and we'd often spend a few days in those villages. Now, maybe there were people in the villages who didn't go to church. Maybe there were people who didn't belong, who belonged to other denominations even. But certainly as a kid, it certainly didn't seem like that. It seemed like everybody belonged to the Anglican Church. I can remember going to one of the villages along the Nass River. You could only drive so far. And once you would arrive at as far as the road took you, you would have to wait until a boat would come and pick you up. And so you'd often have to just honk your horn when you got to the end of the road, and eventually somebody from the village would hear the horns honking, and they would send a boat to come and pick you up and take you into the community. One year, I guess Easter must have been early, and the river was mostly frozen over. So to get from the road to the village, it would be a little bit riskier. We either had to walk across the river or you had to go across on snowmobile. Now, because it was springtime and the river wasn't totally frozen over, I can remember thinking while on the snowmobile, what if one of us falls through? Fortunately, none of us did, but we did hear stories of people who had. For trips to some of the other villages, we traveled entirely by seaplane. I can still remember the feeling coming down to land and the floats hitting the water, and then us gliding to the village dock. Usually we'd stay at the home of the local priest, and people would drop by at various times for a visit. Church services were great celebrations with lively music and great songs of praise. And typically, while we were there, a community feast would be held. Now, for somebody who liked seafood, I was in my element. And over the years, I even got bold enough to try some things for the very first time. I think it was there that I had my first abalone. And certainly it was the place where I first tasted sea lion and seaweed. You know, going to the villages was an eye-opening experience. Even though Prince Rupert was a fairly multicultural community, it was still predominantly a Caucasian community. In Prince Rupert, I was always in the majority. In the villages, though, I wasn't. And it wasn't even close. We were in the minority by far. And that certainly wasn't an experience that I was familiar with. I remember that hitting home on a visit to one of the villages when I was probably, 10, 12 years old or so. We were staying at the house of the village's pastor, and I decided to go out for a walk on my own. I remember seeing another boy, probably about the same age as I was, but he wouldn't come close. And across the street, he shouted a couple of swear words at me and followed those words with "white man." I decided to head back to the house. I remember thinking how rude he was to say that. I mean, he didn't even know me. And yet it wasn't until years later when I reflected on that experience that it dawned on me that that boy likely had had some pretty bad experiences with white people. That it may well have been very understandable for him to have such intense feelings. How had he been treated by white people for him to respond to me in such a way? Now, I feel bad to admit, but I think growing up, I didn't know anything about the residential school system. And yet it wasn't until 1996 that the last residential school closed. I knew that most of the villages around us, they didn't have high schools. And by the time I got to junior high myself, I knew that young people from the villages came to Prince Rupert for their school year, and they would live with family or with friends. Over a period of about 3 or 4 years, we had 2 young people from the villages live with us. One of them was named Carol. She was with us for, 3 years. She became like a sister to me. I already had a blood sister named Carol, but I also had one who belonged to the Tsimshian people. Indigenous young people coming to Prince Rupert for school was something that I knew. But back then, I didn't know that other children were taken from their homes unwillingly and made to attend residential schools. As I think about my experience growing up among the indigenous people of northwestern British Columbia, I think to some extent it shaped me. They were people of the land, they were people of the water, they were people of faith. People who told stories. Stories of the Great Spirit. And they were people who believed that they were to be caring for the Great Spirit's creation. Looking back over the years, we white people haven't had a great track record when it comes to being stewards of creation. When I think of colonial expansion, the image that comes to mind is people coming to conquer the land, people to use the land for their purpose and fulfillment. With the indigenous people, I saw something so different. I saw people who were partners, who were stewards of creation. Now, they may have hunted and fished, but still they recognize the sanctity of creation around them. As I said, I'm a killer whale. But I have to say, I often find myself drawn very much to another animal that plays an important part in indigenous thinking, the eagle. Ask Mandy about the number of times when we're driving or walking and I spot an eagle and I just want to stop and look. In Prince Rupert, the eagles that we saw most of the time were bald eagles. For me, one of the most majestic of birds. For the longest time, I didn't see any bald eagles in Calgary, and yet in this past year, I've seen a number of them. And there's even one that I've seen fairly close to the church here in Hanson Ranch. For Indigenous people, the eagle is a very important animal. Whereas the raven is thought to bring messages down from the Creator, the eagle soars the highest in the heavens and can carry prayers to the Creator. Being high in the sky, the eagle has the greatest perspective on what is below. Whereas we can be so short-sighted, we can have such tunnel vision. An eagle soaring high can see so much wider. In our first reading today, we heard God's word through the prophet Isaiah. And we heard a reference made about eagles. They will soar on wings like eagles, Isaiah said. The people of Israel are at this time, they're nearing the end of their captivity. They were conquered by a foreign power, and they were taken away from their home to live in a new land. And many were feeling as though God just didn't care. I've spoken before about how people back then used to think that that when good things happened, it was because they were in God's favor. And when bad things happened, it was because they weren't. And what made things particularly worse for the people of Israel is that they believed that they were God's chosen people. How could bad things happen to God's people? Could it mean that God had abandoned them? Their time in exile was a devastating time. Where was God? Had God lost interest? I don't know about you, but I marvel in creation. I marvel at the Rocky Mountains. I marvel at thick forests, at raging rivers and mighty waterfalls. When I'm out of the city at night and I look up into the sky, I marvel at the vast number of stars that I can see. And I think, this is incredible. But I have to say that along with the wonder of creation, I'm often reminded how big God is and how little I am. And in times of struggle or in moments of doubt, there can be this temptation to wonder whether God has much more important things to be focusing on than just little old me. The sense I get is that there was such thinking that it crossed the minds of the people of Israel. I mean, when they were looking up at the stars, I think they would have felt pretty small in comparison. And I think it would have made them wonder whether perhaps God might have been focusing on other things rather than focusing on them. And yet through the mouth of the prophets, God, Yahweh, the Great Spirit, had a message for the people of Israel. Listen to what it says. Why do you complain, Jacob? Why do you say, Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired and weary. And his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Salvation would be coming. God had not abandoned his people. No, even though they were a very small part of creation, God was completely committed to them. And that salvation came, didn't it? Not only did the exile end, and the people were allowed to return to their homeland, but years later, the people were able to experience the unfolding of God's ultimate demonstration of salvation. They were able to see that they were embedded in the heart of God. And to know that God would never, ever abandon them. We heard about that in our passage from John's Jesus story this morning. We heard about the time when the Word became flesh and made His dwelling amongst us. So far from the notion of God being remote, God being distant and unreachable, we have God demonstrating that nothing can keep Him from the people and the creation He loves. He is committed completely. So much so that God became one of us. And isn't it interesting how John puts it? The Word became flesh. When we look back at the creation story in the book of Genesis, we hear of how God spoke things into being. And here in the Gospel of John, we hear of how the Word became flesh. A word is something we hear. In the sharing of words, we hear stories. In the sharing of stories, we find relationships being formed. Like you, I was horrified a few weeks ago to hear of the discovery in Kamloops of the bodies of 215 children at the site of a former residential school. The discovery brought with it great sadness. Sadness in the deaths themselves, but sadness also from what led to such schools in the first place. We can't deny it was an attempt to take away cultural identity. It was an attempt to get rid of diversity. It was an attempt by white men and women, Caucasian people like many of us, to make others in our image. It was undergirded by a mentality that we know what's best. And that wasn't just the government's thinking. It was also the thinking of many in the church. Churches, including the Anglican Church, bear guilt. And many of us feel the shame that goes along with that. And you know, since the discovery, more and more people are starting to say things have to change, and they do. We've got to say never again. Not only do we have to say that, but we have to live in ways that declares that every child matters. But we also have to be careful that we just don't try to run in and fix everything. One of the things I've heard people say recently since the discovery in Kamloops is what can we do? How can we make things right? And I think the response that's needed is we need to start listening. It's too easy for us to say, okay, we've got to make things right. Let's just go to all the former sites and get to the bottom of it all. We know what needs to be done. Let's just get into action. But isn't that the mentality that led to this in the first place? We know what needs to be done. Let me just say right here, I don't think we do. But now is the time to start listening. To start listening to the stories of our Indigenous sisters and brothers, and to allow them a say in what happens from here on. To hear how we can walk alongside them, not in front of them, but alongside of them. There are so many stories that need to be told. And we need to be looking for opportunities to hear those stories, to share our stories together, that real relationships might be formed. And we might all see ourselves as sisters and brothers, co-members of the Great Spirit's creation, who created every one of us in God's image, who sent to every one of us the Word made flesh, that every one of us might be reconciled to the Great Spirit and to one another, that together we might soar on wings like eagles. Run and not grow weary. Walk and not be faint. And that through Jesus, our stories might be linked with God's story, now and forever. Let's bow our heads. Great Spirit, we thank you for your love. We thank you that your love knows no boundaries. We thank you that you became flesh and dwelt among us. Lord, help us to walk with humility. Help us to walk in openness, listening to one another, that we might truly get to know one another, that we might be reconciled to one another and to you. These things we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.